Toshifumi Suzuki died last week. He was 93, and if you have spent any time in Japan, you have felt his work every single day, even if you never knew his name. He was the man who built the konbini, the convenience store, not just as a business, as infrastructure, as a part of daily life so essential that most people in Japan cannot imagine the country without it. He was also, by any serious definition, one of the great disruptors of the 20th century. And his career contains what I think is the most important warning in business. Not about competition, not about technology, about what happens to disruptors after they win. Let me take you back to 1973. Suzuki is an executive at Ito-Yokado, a Japanese retailer. Japan's market is moving fast, and it is moving in one direction, toward big, American-style supermarkets, scale, volume. The analysts are clear. Small neighborhood stores are finished. Suzuki looked at that consensus and decided it was wrong. He had seen a 7-Eleven store during a visit to the U.S. He saw something in it that nobody else in his organization seemed to see. He fought the internal opposition, licensed the brand from Southland Corp., and in 1974, opened Japan's first 24-hour convenience store in Toyosu, Tokyo. What came next was not just expansion. It was reinvention. Suzuki did not copy the American model. He completely rebuilt it for Japan. He designed inventory systems that tracked what individual neighborhoods were buying, hour by hour, and adjusted stock in real time. Long before anyone was talking about data-driven retail, Suzuki was already doing it inside tiny corner stores. He made ready-to-eat food a premium offering. He turned the konbini into a place where you could pay your bills, use an ATM, pick up a parcel, and get a hot meal at 3 in the morning. He turned a convenience store into essential public infrastructure. And then, in the early 1990s, Southland Corp., the American company that had originally owned the 7-Eleven brand, went bankrupt, crushed under leverage buyout debt, and Suzuki orchestrated their rescue. The student had become the master. By 2005, he had consolidated everything into 7&I Holdings, 85,000 stores across 20 countries. This is the Suzuki most people will remember. This is the story most obituaries will tell. But I want to tell you the part they will get wrong. In 2016, Suzuki resigned as CEO, not on his own terms. He lost a boardroom battle with activist investor Dan Loeb over a management reshuffle. He had a vision for where the group needed to go. His board disagreed. The disagreement became a public crisis, and one of the greatest business builders in Japanese history walked out the door. When he left, he did not blame the investors. He did not blame short-termism or ungrateful boards or the changing nature of capital markets. He blamed himself. That is rare. That is admirable. But I want to ask the harder question. What actually happened? In my book, Disrupt or Be Disrupted, I argue that the greatest risk a successful disruptor faces is not external. It is not a competitor or a new technology or a market shift. It is something that happens inside, quietly, gradually, almost invisibly. I call it crystallization. The systems that made the disruption work become the walls that prevent the next one. The certainties that gave the leader their edge harden into dogma. The organization that was once built around radical openness starts defending what it has rather than questioning what comes next. Suzuki's original disruption was extraordinary precisely because he was willing to be wrong about everything. The market was going one way, he went the other. He had no guarantee he was right. He acted anyway. But by the time Dan Loeb arrived, 7&I Holdings had sprawled into supermarkets, department stores, and financial services, none of which were performing at the level of the konbini core. Suzuki had a vision for how to fix that. He was certain about it. And that certainty, that conviction, is exactly what closed the organization off to other possibilities. The disruptor had stopped asking whether the world was changing. He had started telling the world what it should look like. In Charismatic Disruption, I talk about what I call disruptive curiosity. It is the capacity that separates leaders who disrupt once from leaders who disrupt continuously. It is not strategy. Suzuki had brilliant strategy. It is not data. Suzuki understood data better than almost anyone in global retail. It is the disciplined, ongoing ability to keep questioning your own model, especially when it is working. Why is that so hard to sustain? Three reasons. The first is structural. As a disruptive idea scales into an institution, the people most comfortable with uncertainty get gradually replaced by people better at operating with certainty. That is not a failure. It is the logic of growth. But it creates a gap between the leader's instincts and the organization's capacity to act on them. The second is psychological. Success is a powerful anesthetic. It reduces the urgency that drove the original disruption, and in Japan especially, where Suzuki built something not just commercially dominant, but woven into the fabric of daily life. Success had an almost mythological quality. It is very hard to question a model that feels like the national infrastructure. The third is this. The next disruption is a different problem. 7-Eleven Japan remained, and remains, the world's most capable convenience store operator. His original disruption held. What failed was the second act, repositioning a mature conglomerate for the next generation of growth. That requires a different kind of leadership, and almost nobody teaches you how to make that transition. I work with foreign executives in Japan who face a version of this every single day. They arrive with disruptive intent, a new model, a new expectation of how business can work here. Many of them succeed. They build something real. And then, quietly, over years, the organization they built starts to look more and more like the organizations they came here to disrupt. The processes calcify. The assumptions stop being questioned. The original edge gets managed away in the name of consistency. This is not a character flaw. It is organizational gravity. It pulls on every institution, every leader, every strategy that has ever worked. The only defense is to build disruption into the structure of how you lead, not as a crisis response, not as a one-time strategic initiative, as a standing practice, something that is normal, required, and institutionally safe. Suzuki asked the right question in 1973. What if the conventional wisdom is wrong, and we are the ones to prove it? He answered that question brilliantly. His life's work was the proof. So here is what I want to leave you with. Who is asking that question inside your organization right now? Not who asked it 5 years ago when you were building. Who is asking it today about the model you have already built? And when they ask it, what happens to them? The answer to that question will tell you whether your disruptive ambitions will be grounded before ever taking flight.